Welcome to Red Alert Radio, grassroots radio with an ear on the issues that matter to you.
Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa, ko Greg Preston tēnei. This is Greg Presland and this is Red Alert Radio. And with me today is Newlyn MP Deborah Russell. Tēnā koe, Deborah.
Kia ora, great to be here again.
So we certainly live in interesting times, don't we?
Well, this is quite interesting doing this over Zoom because you and I live about 500 metres apart, maybe 400 metres apart, but the way we have to talk these days is by phone or by Zoom or all those sorts of technical ways instead of actually meeting in person.
It's become a new social norm, hasn't it?
It's very quickly, yeah.
And I think once we get out of this, I think a few people will still use this technique quite often, so there might be a new way of behaving.
Actually, it's interesting thinking about that because we've gotten quite used to doing Zoom meetings and the like quite quickly. But also it lays bare some of the deficiencies of meeting over technology as well. There's real value in being in the same room as people, at least some of the time.
I thought today we'd talk about COVID-19, which is obviously having a profound effect on everything that central government does and local government does. And I've noticed something very interesting, and that is people are becoming socialists.
Funny about that, isn't it? All that pandemic literature we read, or the apocalyptic movies or the end of the world movies, and they always fantasize that people will sort of descend into little groups who will just fight for themselves, turn out not to be true. It turns out that in a disaster situation like this, we actually all get together and help each other and try to engage in a collective effort.
The strength of the collective, yeah.
Yeah. That's part of what we're seeing, which we might call a socialist endeavour. But the other thing that I find really interesting is people turning to the government for help and getting it.
Yes, Matthew Hooton the other day on Radio New Zealand, he talked about the reforms of the 80s and the 90s. He acknowledged that they had caused long-term adverse damage to people. They were done too roughly, and the results were more damaging than they needed to be.
Yeah.
And when the right winger comes out and says those sorts of things.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You and I were both in our sort of late teens, early 20s through those 80s and 90s. And what I recall, particularly with the reforms of the 90s, was the carnage in the agricultural sector in particular, where the mental health rates amongst farmers and suicide rates just skyrocketed. And it's because change was needed. A whole lot of our agriculture was propped up by supplementary minimum prices. And so we did need the change. But it was pushed through so quickly and so fast that the rate of change was too much for people to take on. And I think that's what we're seeing at partly in our response to climate change, is people trying to take it slowly and take people with them. Right at the moment, the change is being forced on us by a completely external factor. It's very, very rapid, but there's a whole lot of care being taken to make sure that people stay in touch with each other and with society, and that they're not discarded along the way.
Yeah, the human response as well as the economic response and the health response are all part of the mix, aren't they?
Yeah. So I've been delighted to see the response around helping business, and particularly small business and smaller businesses to keep going. Because, of course, once we come out the other side of this, we want viable businesses to still be there because that creates employment for other people and it creates structure as well. So, business is a critical part of our community. But the other thing that we're seeing is the emphasis on making sure that our health system is up to speed. And that's incredibly socialist.
Yeah. So can I ask you about the wage subsidy? I've never seen such a large government spend done so quickly and have so few strings attached, such little oversight.
Yeah.
My impression is it was a vital part of the lockdown, and if it wasn't done, we would be in a very difficult situation right now.
A lot of the thinking behind the wage subsidy was making sure that money got out the door quickly. In contrast to Australia, where the assistance for businesses is only going to come through in about May, the emphasis here was on keeping businesses going. And we know that cash flow is critical to business. So that was part of it, was getting the money out the door quickly, and the wage subsidy was a way to do it. But the other thing with that wage subsidy is it must flow through to the employees. So it helps employers to keep their employees on board. It keeps them in touch with their employer. And it ensures that people at least have some money in their pockets, in their back pocket, during this really extraordinary time.
And it gives everyone 3 months to take a breath and just work out what's going to happen rather than make decisions in a panic situation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the worries there is people who've been on comparatively high income suddenly dropping to maybe the level of the wage subsidy, because there are various conditions around that. But the fact is we have a large proportion of New Zealanders who are quite low paid, and we're at least keeping, even though it's still a low pay, it's still at least getting through to them, at least getting some money through to them. So hopefully we'll all survive this.
Mm. So that's the urgent stopgap response, if you like. And the proposed infrastructure spend is the next part, isn't it? It's the let's create jobs and let's keep the economy going over the next few years.
That's the somewhat longer-term response, is getting those infrastructure projects going. I think I can't remember what numbers the Minister of Finance put around that, but it's, you know, tens of billions between what was going to be done in the budget and the extra stuff that's going to be done now. And, yeah, that is it's nation-building stuff. You know, it's saying, well, what big projects do we need to get done? And, of course, those big projects, like building roads and building, I don't know, whatever else is going to go into that, it employs people, it keeps firms going, it keeps all our construction industry going, and we want them long term, and it keeps people in jobs, and we get something good out of it. But again, it's going to be interesting seeing what ends up being government owned at the end of this, and to what extent we keep that contracting model in place, and whether we start thinking a little bit longer term about the entire structure of the economy, not just what things we should build.
Yeah, there's a nostalgic remembrance of the Ministry of Works, isn't there? Because they built roads and dams and electric systems and all sorts of things that we still use now. So the state certainly has a role, doesn't it?
I think it does. Look, the criticism, there were sort of, if you like, two major criticisms of the Ministry of Works back in the 1980s and 90s when it all got dismantled. And the first one was sort of an empirical one. It said that the Ministry of Works was really, really inefficient. And that's an empirical question. It's not clear to me that the Ministry of Works necessarily was better or worse than the private sector would have been in that space, as to whether or not it was inefficient. But the other big question was whether or not the government should be owning that construction infrastructure. And I think that's a question we're going to start to revisit, as to, you know, whether the government should be owning key strategic assets. So is the Ministry of Works a key strategic asset? Well, actually, it might be.
Yes, the neoliberal response over the last 40 years is definitely not.
Yeah.
We might be in a situation where we're thinking, oh, maybe we should try it again and see how it goes.
Yeah, and it's not just the Ministry of Works, it's other critical pieces of infrastructure too, like for a small island nation at the bottom of the world, our airline is actually incredibly important to us. Maybe, and of course we still do own the majority of that airline, but maybe we should own it all. Who knows? But that's the sort of question that we're going to start asking ourselves. So there's some really big macroeconomic questions to be going through in the next few months.
Mm. Ask you some questions about the local projects that we might see. Northwestern Busway, is that on the sort of possibility?
You'd have to ask the Minister of Transport, who is conveniently also the Minister of Economic Development. But, yeah, that's exactly the sort of project I'd like to see funded, you know, because it has a triple whammy of it. You know, one is it works really effectively to help with the traffic congestion in Auckland, so that's a really good thing to do. And the other one, of course, is that public transport in general and using it more effectively is really critical in terms of our response to climate change. So there's those two big bonuses out of it, as well as it being an infrastructure project which will employ people and help with the response to COVID-19.
And another project that you've supported is the Waitakere Hospital extension. And coincidentally, I know that the board put their application in last month for the project to go ahead. So,
well, yes, I've certainly been urging that along with the other two local MPs. I would love to see a full service hospital at Waitakere, and seems like a good time to build it. And of course, you know, it makes sense as well. If you look at the criteria for building hospitals, they need to be close to a to motorways, and they need to be well located so that the population to use them can get to them easily. We don't have a full service hospital out west, and I think it's about time we did. So that would be a great project to get across the line. And of course, the other brilliant thing about the Waitakere, building a full service hospital at Waitakere, is that there's a large amount of land there, which is already there, part of the hospital campus. So there's no lack of space for building a hospital.
It's a relatively simple construction job, isn't it, on land that they have already. So, yeah.
I don't know how simple it is to build hospitals.
Relatively.
Yes. I think there's probably a lot of architecture and design work that needs to be thought about, but a lot of that's been done already. And, of course, the other thing to think about is how big we want that hospital to be. The North Shore one is going to end up being at about 800 beds, which apparently in terms of research around the effectiveness of hospitals, that's about as big as you can get a hospital before it gets to be too big to be a good institution. So perhaps we could be looking at a really large hospital out west, but I wouldn't see us going any larger than that 800 beds.
Mm. And what about rail to the airport? I can see that at least for the next few years, air flights are going to be, you know, are considerably fewer than they are right now, and tourism is not really going to be happening. So is that still a project that should be favoured?
Oh, well, I think so. Again, I don't know what discussions are happening further up the line, but that rail to the airport was, obviously it was about servicing the airport, but it was also about servicing that whole area down south, and in particular, all the workers who are located around the airport. It is a transport hub for us. And there's a heap of industries that are located down there with workers trying to, not even necessarily working at the airport, but workers around in that whole airport area. So it's about transporting workers there as well.
And the tourism traffic was actually a relatively small part of it.
That's right. And actually, tourism is going to be really interesting in the next few years. Obviously, our international tourism is going to take a hit, but we won't have people coming to New Zealand for holidays. But equally, I think that New Zealanders aren't going to be going overseas for holidays as much. And once the movement restrictions are off around the country, I think it'll be a bit of a campaign for us all to go visit our own country.
Head off to Queenstown in the South Island. And, yes.
Yeah, or you know, down the east coast of the North Island, or anywhere that we can go that will help to support our local tourism industry, and down to Rotorua or Taupo, or anywhere that we can help support it. And that just seems to me like, if we can, we should be supporting New Zealand industry at this time.
It's one of the benefits of living in a beautiful country.
It is. It is. Actually, it's interesting thinking about that too, is one of the things I decided to do at the start of this year, which I was doing anyway, was I was thinking I need to buy into the slow clothes movement, which says that instead of buying more clothes all the time because they're so cheap, that you actually look at what you've got in your wardrobe and just wear that. And I thought about that for a while, but well, I could do that. And then I said, but maybe I will buy clothes if they are New Zealand designed and New Zealand made. So that was something I already decided to do, and now it becomes even more important to support our local fashion designers. But aside from that, it's hardly a key infrastructure asset, the fashion industry, though I do think it's worth supporting. But starting to think about what other sorts of manufacturing we should perhaps be supporting here onshore in New Zealand of critical stuff that we need here. So we've got a firm in Whanganui that makes masks, surgical masks. What other sorts of vital equipment ought we to be making onshore instead of importing from overseas? Again, that's a question I think we'll need to be having a long, hard think about in the next few months.
Yes, if the whole ethos behind world trade, if we're not exporting as much, then we need to make as much as we can locally, don't we?
We do. But in terms of trade, that's another interesting one, because one of the things that I've often thought is, how lucky we are to live in a breadbasket at the bottom of the world, right? I've thought that for many years, and that's really true now. Whatever else, in New Zealand, we can feed ourselves in this country. We actually feed about 25 million people worldwide, and there's only 5 million of us live here, so we produce far more food than we need for ourselves. And in recent days, we've signed up some really important agreements about keeping trade going. And in particular, we've signed up to one with Singapore. An agreement, I don't know whether it's a signed agreement, but there is an agreement between us and Singapore that we will keep the trade routes between us and Singapore open. If you think about that, Singapore is an island state, and pretty much all of the island is taken up by buildings. They don't grow their own food, it's imported. So from their point of view, ensuring that they've got access to food supplies from New Zealand and presumably from elsewhere is really important. From our point of view, having access to technology and manufacturing from Singapore is very important. So there's a real mutual benefit to that trade. As part of that agreement too, that our Minister of Trade has been working on, there are agreements to keep trade routes open with, I think it's Singapore, Chile, Argentina, Australia, Canada. So if you think about that, that's Southern Hemisphere nations and nations up that we can access through the Pacific.
So you can see a reorganising of the whole trade system. Instead of being multilateral, we're going to become more bilateral traders?
Possibly. That was sort of happening already. I would have thought it might still be multilateral, but in much smaller groups.
And we should talk about America. America's not going to come out of this as well as we think, I suspect.
Actually, it's pretty grim reading looking at the infection and death rates coming out of the States at the moment. I've been watching worldometers.info/coronavirus, which has got a daily telly, and it flips over at midnight Greenwich Mean Time, GMT, every night. So, but just before it flipped over today, they'd reported 1,900 deaths from the US in the last day. That's an extraordinary number of people dying, and their infection rate is now, I think, up at around 360,000. I think we're looking at a disaster in the US. It's not just those immediate tragedies, but I think, isn't it something like 10 million people have applied for unemployment assistance in the last couple of weeks,
yeah.
Which has never been seen.
And that's a question of leadership, isn't it? You can contrast, if I put this as gently as I can, Trump's communication of the issues to the public has been confusing.
Yeah.
And the level of preparation is not really there, whereas Jacinda's given us a very clear steer in New Zealand, hasn't she? And the decision-making's been quite definite and quite focused.
You know, I was just thinking about this because... there's an obvious contrast with the US, but there's even a contrast with our near neighbours, say, in Australia, where they have got lockdowns in place. But something they don't have there is what we have here. It was the first thing that Jacinda announced with that nationwide address was the four levels of the alert system, so alert levels 1 through 4. And as far as I know, no other nation has that. But it's a brilliant piece of communication because it structures our thinking around COVID-19 really nicely. We all have a clear understanding of what we're doing and the risks at any one time. And it also gives us a clear sense of progress. If we can go from, at the end of this lockdown period, if we can go from alert level 4 down to alert level 3, we'll have a sense of having achieved something rather than just that, you know, various lockdown measures might get taken off at various times. So I think that was a brilliant piece of communication right at the start. There have been some mix-ups along the way, some things which could have been communicated a little clearer. But of course there would be, because it's all moved so rapidly. But in general, the communication has been crystal clear.
My sense is that people are supportive of what the government are doing, and they're buying into what's happening precisely because they know where we are.
Yep.
And what we have to do to improve things.
Actually, I think that's right. Look, the other fantastic communicator we've got at the moment has been Dr. Ashley Bloomfield, our Director General of Health. And a few weeks ago when we first met him on TV, you know, he seemed to be a little bit diffident and perhaps unsure, but he has grown in stature as a communicator, I think, in extraordinary ways. And he stands up there every day and gives us the figures. He answers questions. He explains matters for journalists. And that level of transparency, I think, also helps enormously.
And do you think that's another difference between the way New Zealand's handled it and overseas have handled it? Here we've relied on people who know what they're talking about to communicate what's happening. Whereas in America, for instance, Trump seems to try to handle that aspect of it, but he keeps fudging the message and he gets it wrong too.
And he seems to overrule his own experts, which is deeply worrying. Look, I guess Trump is good at communicating messages. He's very good at he honed the skills over many years as to what would communicate well through a TV screen, as he did his years and years and years of work on The Apprentice, and to what would work in terms of communication. And in a sense, that's something that Jacinda is very good at too. She's good at getting across all the information and crystallising it for us and communicating it. I think the difficult thing with President Trump is that he likes being the centre of attention, and he doesn't like being contradicted. And he also, I think he's beset by the two worries that we have. One is the health of our people, but the other one is whether or not we can keep our economy going. And he's not managing to balance those pressures in a way that our own leadership here is in New Zealand. I think that's why we're getting the confusing messages from him. He desperately wants his economy open again because he can see the all sorts of the ill effects that are going on there. But he hasn't got that clear overriding thought that we need to make sure that our people are safe and then we can get the economy running again.
So he's got two conflicting messages happening at once, whereas Jacinda's message is very clear. We cannot afford to have the health effects. And, oh, by the way, we're going to look after the economy as we go along, but the health effects are a primary concern.
Yeah. And it's not that the economy doesn't matter. It's just saying, actually, we've got to get people well, we've got to keep them safe, and if we can do that, then we can run the economy in such a way that it benefits us all. So, yes, I think she's been brilliant at that.
Can I ask some questions about the environmental effects? First of all, going back to the infrastructure projects, isn't this an ideal time for us to do projects specifically aimed at climate change? Because we're going to have another crisis at some stage. Why don't we get on now and address that?
Yes, it is to do the climate change related projects, but it's worth thinking about what they would be. But that's why, you know, the North Western Busway looks like a really worthwhile thing to do. I don't know which projects are coming through the pipeline in terms of that infrastructure build. I know that that's being worked on. But, yeah, to me, the sorts of projects we need to be involved in are the ones that are the big public service projects, and that necessarily entails the climate stuff.
And the concern's been expressed to me that road projects tend to be ready to go. There tend to be a lot of them. The worry is that we will build lots of roads because it's easy to do rather than a good thing to do.
I think that is a worry. But again, if you look at the infrastructure announcement that we made towards the start of the year before COVID-19 was starting to be a huge worry for us, in terms of the roading projects that were going to be undertaken, it wasn't just building more roads, it was building roads and cycleways and pedestrian ways and making sure that you get mixed mode transport going. And roads remain important. I mean, we shouldn't kid ourselves about that. It's our major means of travel in this country. But it is saying roads and not only roads. So it is looking for that mixed mode of transportation. I'd like to see more rail, so that would be nice.
Just a couple of questions about the, again, about the environment. People are living much simpler lives right now, and a lot of people are quite enjoying it. Yeah, and we look outside, the sky's blue, and there's no air pollution. It's Auckland is a stunningly beautiful place right now.
Yes.
Do you think once we get through this that there's going to be a greater reluctance to go back to the way that things were? And it will change us all?
That would be nice. But I think people will crave a sense of normality. And for many people, it is going to be using their cars and things like that. So, no, I don't think that people will say, hey, let's hang on to these simpler stuff. I think, look, for many of us, in some ways, it is pleasant to be living this simpler life. But, you know, we live in a beautiful suburb. We can access the resources we need. If you're someone living in South Auckland who's dependent on a wage and who just needs to get to work, at the moment what you are is constrained rather than enabled. And I suspect that once those constraints are lifted, I think people will go back to their cars. So to me, that's sort of nice thought, but I don't think it's going to fly. I think much as I like baking my own bread, I think we'll be back to buying it rather than making it, just because that's the easier thing to do. So in terms of that long-term behaviour shift, I think it will come from the longer-term projects we had in mind already, around climate change, around shifting from a fossil fuel-fueled fleet that's to an electric fleet and things like that. It's that sort of longer-term change that will get the real behavioural change rather than the short, sharp shock.
Yeah. A couple of questions on your favourite subject, tax. Short to medium term, the government's going to have to pay the cost of borrowing as well as the increased spend on infrastructure.
Yeah.
So short term, yep, we can get the credit card out and start spending.
Yeah.
But we're going to have to change the flows around, aren't we, and sort of get back to a sense of balance.
Yes, we are.
Is it time to look at tax rates?
Oh, look, I think it's time to look at tax rates anyway. We need to make sure, particularly, that lower paid people have more money in their back pocket. So I think we'll see some shuffling around in the tax thresholds. But I think that rather than just looking at tax rates, because you can shuffle some stuff around there, we need to look at what we do and don't tax in our overall economy. And so I think we can do some more work in that space.
So capital gains, maybe have to have another look at it.
Not as a capital gains tax per se, but in some form or other, I think we're going to have to look at what isn't taxed at the moment and whether or not it should be. Something I'd look at a little bit more in that space is maybe pollution levies, and use those to mitigate some of the effects of polluting activity.
It presents government with a clean slate though, doesn't it? Because suddenly we're going to have a brand new set of fundamentals that we're going to have to address somehow. So,
yeah, it's going to be interesting looking at how we do it. Look, something that has come out of this too, I think, is that we won't hear any calls for reduction in the company tax rate for a while now. There'll be a sense that businesses need to pay their fair share of this, that it can't just all go down to wage and salary earners to pay for the costs of this. On the other, you know, it's going to be a long-term project repaying all that borrowing. But, of course, one way to repay it is to think about what products we can make here in a way that we can sell to the rest of the world and do it without, at the same time, increasing greenhouse gas emissions and things like that. So I think we'll be looking for better value add on our agricultural exports.
And if we can manage that, then I think this current government will go into the history books the same way that the first Labor government did.
I think so too. And I think, I think we've got an extraordinarily gifted leader at the moment. And I think with the clarity of leadership that's coming from the Prime Minister and the Minister of Finance, I think we'll go a long way.
Thank you, Deborah. The time has flown past. We should do this again sometime in the not too distant future.
Get together next week at 9.05 a.m. Or listen online anytime on planetaudio.org.nz/redalertradio.